From pit lane to podium, the Las Vegas Grand Prix is providing fans a race day experience at the speed they deserve. With the help of T-Mobile for Business, our 5G advanced network solutions are powering race day operations with event-wide connectivity. From streamlined gate entry to an immersive app, giving fans blazing fast access to the sport they love. This is accelerating innovation. This is the Las Vegas Grand Prix with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Hello and welcome to another episode of National Review's Capitol Record. I am your host, David Bahnsen. I am having the time of my life in 2024 with this podcast because I really do believe that we have gotten some of the best guests we've ever had and recorded some of the best episodes we've ever had this year. I've always enjoyed doing it, but I just feel like we're on this particular winning streak right now, and I don't want to disrupt that, and we're not going to disrupt it today. We have a first-time guest today. It's someone that I have been reading and following for some time. I have actually done some stuff with him in the past when I had a book of my own come out about dividend growth investing, but my guest today is portfolio manager Daniel Paris, who has a brand new book out called The Ownership Dividend. And it is a privilege, Daniel, to welcome you to National Review's Capitol Record.
David, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, how long have you been at Federated now?
Oh, dear. I just passed my probationary period and got a key to the men's room. It's, I think, 22 years.
22 years. And so the entire time at Federated, you've been in some form of equity management?
I started as a senior analyst and very quickly gravitated to an older employee who was focused exclusively on dividends. And given my training as a historian and background and conservative inclinations, we got on quite well. And within a year or two of joining, I was really just working with him and joined the named portfolio management team in 2006. So that's 17, 18 years ago, and have been for the last decade or so been overseeing the dividend portfolios here.
When you got to Federated, began your career starting as an analyst, were you already a convert to a dividend growth way of thinking?
You know, I was not, because, David, I'm actually a convert from a different profession entirely. I'm a historian, and I still really self-identify as a historian. I was trained during the late stages of the Cold War, the Reagan era Cold War, as a historian of the Soviet Union. Thank you, State Department, Department of Education, and so forth for supporting my training. But by the time I came out with my PhD, the Soviet Union was gone and funding had disappeared and interest had disappeared. It's come back, and we can get to that in just a moment, as it were. But at the time, the interest and flows and student enrollments shifted over to Arabic studies and Chinese studies, where they frankly belong. So I decided to transition into business and had limited kind of exposure to the stock market, other than kind of Lewis Rukeyser and various bits and pieces from an earlier time. But when I did join the profession and then Federated, my inclination as a historian kind of came back up. And it was pretty obvious at that point that focusing on dividends made the most sense to me personally, and that's how I ended up. So it's really the history. You can take the boy out of history, you can't take the history out of the boy.
Well, isn't that the truth? I actually wish more portfolio managers had studied history, and not in the sense that others could mean the same thing, although I agree with it too. But I think there are others who would say, boy, portfolio managers would do a better job if they had studied certain market cycles more, or market history. But I would think that even though some may consider your vita to have a lot of idiosyncratic things on it, you know, the doctoral level of understanding in international studies, the Soviet Union of that nature, it would be hard for people to see that as connected to markets. But I think that grasp of history, that appetite for history, I think there's a richness in it that absolutely has to help in the way we understand markets and analyze companies.
Yeah, some very basic ideas, which you can apply in almost any profession. But if you enter into a profession, or if you just wake up this morning and you are in a profession, it can't hurt to ask the following question. Where did the current rules come from? How did they evolve? And are they still relevant? For instance, I had a book come out in 2018 where I asked those questions about a modern portfolio theory, which I thought is very dated and aged, not a popular view, but basically asking a historian's approach to, Harry Markowitz is fixing some problems from the 1920s and 30s in the 1950s and 60s. That's really good. Kudos. But do those problems still attend and do those solutions still apply 50, 60, 70 years later? I had a view on that. And the same thing with the current book is that I found it anomalous as an income investor that the U.S. stock market has kind of been stripped of its dividends over the last 30, 40 years. I thought that's strange because chapter one of every finance book is all about the cash flows, and it hasn't changed. It's even chapter one of current finance books, yet no one seems to pay any attention. So how did we get to this state of affairs? And that's where the historian kicks in and says, for most of recorded history, cash flows mattered. Cash flows to company owners mattered. It's just the last couple decades they haven't. Why is that the case? So that's the historian's approach to asking why or how did our current environment come about and is it still relevant?
And so when you got to Federated, was there a mentor there that really brought you along in applying what you ended up believing about markets, about business, about investing, about risk and reward to the concept of dividend growth? Was a lot of this self-discovery?
Yeah, a little bit of everything, but I have to credit Walter Bean, who was more the cranky old man, and he happily wore that title of cranky old man, that people need income, people invest for income. And, you know, the internet age might not have been so kind to him from an investment perspective, but he stuck to his guns. And really, when others were not interested in supporting a product that was focused on generating income from equity, he was, and to his credit, stuck with it and eventually kind of won over a clientele, as your business has, won over a clientele that's focused on that, even if perhaps it's not the clientele that dominates the CNBC pages and the front pages of the Wall Street Journal every day. He retired in 2015, sadly passed away last year, but he really started the franchise. And then I came along as the trained historian and writer and kind of build it out and rewriting the precepts of dividend-focused investing, cash flow-based investing, things that he instinctively knew, and had read the original, 1934, Graham and Dodd, that type of thing. Build it out as a franchise over the last two decades. But credit to him, and also credit, frankly, to the chief investment officer here, Steve Auth. He joined roughly the same I did. He's a growth guy. He is unabashedly a growth guy, but he is a very wide-ranging intellect, and he understands that there are many ways to do this. And he's been also very supportive of building up this dividend franchise.
Yeah, Steve is one actually I need to have on this podcast as well. He and I have spoken together at some of the same conferences. We have a lot of similarities in our worldview and things that animate us. And I think Steve would be a great person to have on. We share some common friendships and so forth as well. So that it's great that he's been supportive of what you've done there at Federated. In the month of April, we're going to do a special on this podcast. I'm going to call it Mentor Month. And unfortunately, my father's been passed away since 1995, but luckily he recorded a lot of information. I'm going to do one podcast where I'm kind of interacting with some of his material and so forth. But then Larry Kudlow and a guy named Nick Murray, who's very well known in financial advisory profession, and then Lowell Miller are going to be the four guests these are the four individuals personally, professionally, through various kind of categories of life have been my mentors. And Lowell was really, basically the one who introduced me to dividend growth. And so it sounds like the role Walter played for you is similar to the one Lowell played for me. And when you said a sort of curmudgeon-y older guy, that's Lowell too, but what an intellect and a profound way of thinking about cash flows. Tell me about the new book you've written before. You've been managing dividend portfolios for a long time. What prompted this book, and what might be kind of a unique takeaway from its message?
Yeah, so this is sort of the fourth book on dividend-focused investing that I've written, and the first three were met with utter silence. And if I think about it, there's a good reason for that, and it's really the fourth book addresses that, and that is that, yeah, I can articulate at a practitioner level or at a historical level reasons why this is an important way to approach investing if you're going to be a minority investor in companies, that you want a cash nexus, that you want as an agency management mechanism that is controlling a little bit management, you want to be paid in cash and so forth and so on. But nobody cared for much of the last 20 years. It's sort of a boutique business. Those who care about dividends migrate to the dividend managers, but the broader market has moved in another direction. And so the first three books where I'm articulating, hey, this is a good idea, this is a good idea, why? Let me show you the history and the intellectual background for this, I was delighted to write them, but they didn't have much of an impact. The fourth book addressed the question of why the first three haven't, and that is really approaching what has happened to the stock market the last three or four decades, and why dividend investing, which is really investing, is now a boutique strategy. There's enough of it to support you and to support me and so forth. But how did it get out of the mainstream and become more of a boutique strategy? And this book looks at the issues or the trends over the last three or four decades. The theme running through it, which affects everything in the financial services sector, is 40 years of declining interest rates. It's really changed investor, practitioner, and corporate behavior profoundly. With each and every year lower interest rates, I'm referring mostly to the 10-year as the rate that drives people in the equity business. But the implications of having two generations, 40 years of declining interest rates, of ever lower risk rates, ever greater invitation to kind of speculation and reckless behavior, all justified by lower risk rates if you follow the academic finance of using the 10-year as the basis for a risk rate. There are a couple other threads that run through as to why the dividends disappeared. The rise of buybacks starting in 1982 with the change in the safe harbor provisions, the rise of NASDAQ and Silicon Valley is a positive thing. And also, David, more to the combination of our interests, kind of in the background, but maybe in the foreground for this audience, is the rise of global neoliberalism, the deregulatory environment. It's amazing how much these factors all started exactly the same time. You have Deng Xiaoping comes to power in 1979, Margaret Thatcher 1979, Ronald Reagan 1980, the high point of interest rates 1981, the safe water harbor provision 1982, and the aggressive emergence in a good way of Silicon Valley companies starting in the 1980s, and you have 40 years of clear sailing for that paradigm, that deregulatory globalization paradigm, to have its way. And in that environment, you know, the stock market becomes less of an income investment platform or dividend growth investment platform for those companies that have that ability than just a buy low, sell high, repeat frequently stock platform stripped of income. And that's how I think we got to this state. And then, as I'm sure you're keenly aware, the last three or four years, that whole model, everything in that model has reversed course, starting with globalization and the supply chain, global supply chains and just-in-time supply chains with COVID in China crashing that, the political consensus in the United States about global neoliberalism coming to a rapid end with Donald Trump, and even the end of the need for consensus, interest rates bottoming. I don't know where they're going to go, but I don't think they're going to go, you know, back to 50 or 100 basis points. Russia invading Ukraine, challenging again another form of the neoliberal ideal. Buybacks, I think the bloom is off the rose. They're still legal. Lots of people use them. I just posted a piece on buybacks. And NASDAQ's matured, and we've seen a number of companies in NASDAQ announce dividends. And again, they continue to be world-changing, world-beating companies, but even they are coming around. They're no longer just growth companies that need to reinvest every single penny. They have hundreds of millions, billions of dollars that they're using for buybacks, and now they're coming around and maturing enough to start paying a dividend. So the environment in which dividends disappeared, I think, has run its course, and we are set up for a paradigm shift back to, not back to some Halcyon past, but back to what I return is just the return of the cash nexus, a normal business environment in which a minority owner in a business, private business, public business, real estate, whatever the case may be, farmland, would expect a cash stream from said investment. It's not that radical of a concept.
This is a message from our friends at American Habits from the State Policy Network. We the people, do you ever think about what that means and what happened to it? We the people certainly did not mean an imperial city full of unelected bureaucrats deciding everything from kindergarten curricula to nursing home funding formulas. We the people mean self-government, a free people deciding most things in their families and communities and delegating some authority to their towns and states while passing along just a small amount of that power to the national government. How did things get so upside down? At American Habits, we tell stories of real people with real solutions, all working to restore federalism and self-government. If you're a public official, come get involved. If you're a citizen, come and see the new standard for American leadership. No matter who you are, come help us renew the forgotten but not lost habit of American self-government. Visit AmericanHabits.org to learn more. That's AmericanHabits.org.
So let me ask you a question. There's so much to unpack there, and so many great thoughts and wonderful historical context of as you said at the beginning. You know, where did the current rules come from? How did we get here? A prominent one in your thesis of the case has to do with interest rates, and that there was a decline in market appetite for dividends as the risk-free rate was declining. It was putting a bigger shine than it historically been there on growth-oriented investment. Is your belief that the key variable is the level of the risk-free rate or the direction of the risk-free rate? Is it present tense or future tense that is driving that sort of market appetite and market behavior?
Yeah, I actually would step back and even call into question, not as a practical matter, because as a practical matter, using a risk-free rate and then something extra is really deeply rooted in the system. Even before we had CAPM, which enshrines it and defines what's the risk-free measure and how you determine the little bit extra for something risk.
But for our non-PM listeners, which is to say 99.9% of them, CAPM is referring to the capital pricing model. Okay.
So let me back up just a little bit. The risk-free notion, I think most of the listeners will understand, a concept that that in making any investment, again, farmland, real estate, your brother-in-law's business, a public stock, an IPO, whatever the case may be, that you are trying to figure out what the appropriate level of risk might be. And it is awfully handy to have a base level, a risk-free level. And in the public equity markets, what passes for that is essentially the U.S. 10-year treasury. And a couple folks in the 1960s came up with a formula that allowed you to figure out what the risk and therefore what you should expect, kind of a discount rate or what your expected rate of return should be. I'm not super comfortable with that. I acknowledge it as a practical measure. It goes back centuries and centuries, long before the 1960s, long before the 10-year existed, except 10-year meaning the U.S. government treasury that's due in 10 years, the interest rate on that. Goes back centuries, this notion of a risk-free concept and add something to it. But investments have been made in absolute discount, with absolute discount numbers, without regard to what a risk-free rate is. And I have to say I'm a little bit more comfortable with that. If you look at the history of modern portfolio theory and the emergence of the cap, and modern portfolio theory is for your listeners is basically can be reduced to a diversified portfolio is better than a non-diversified one. You can toggle how much risk and how much return you might expect through very basic levers of diversification. But so I'm not a super fan of using the notion of the risk-free rate, particularly if, and there's a section of the book on this, so I think you'll agree, the U.S. 10-year treasury is subject to so many push and pull factors that are not really straight up financial risk. There are a lot
but
of
isn't
politics.
All isn't all you're saying that you prefer to look at the 10-year as the risk-free rate?
I do. I acknowledge that other people do. I take that with a big grain of salt.
Got it.
And So I say, you know, what runs through this is the decline of the 40-year decline of the risk-free rate, the 10-year. However, I'm not a big believer in using it as a risk-free rate, but I acknowledge that everyone else does, so I have to pay attention to it. And so what I say is, listen, I'm not certain where risk rates, and I actually draw a distinction in the book between interest rates and risk rates. an interest rate is what's on the screen. A risk rate is what's the butterflies in your stomach right before you hit the buy button. It's the middle of the night when you wake up. Should I do this? Should I not do this? That's the risk rate. The risk rate and the interest rate kind of go in parallel and have come down for decades. But I really think they're too, the U.S. 10-year is too cluttered with other factors to make it a good, pure risk rate.
That so being I've always said, been taught that the 10-year is the product of the risk-free rate combined with something else. So in other words, the clutter you refer to is added to the risk-free rate to get a 10-year, and that the risk-free rate itself is a component of the 10-year but not equivalent to it. And so that's why they use a 90-day T-bill or a Fed funds rate or some ultra-short-term rate. And then you allow the clutter of growth expectations or inflation expectations or whatnot to be added to as either a premium or not to the risk-free rate to get a 10-year. But it sounds like what you're saying is that the interest rate, whether regardless of duration, is not really the same as a risk rate, because the risk rate is going to factor in a certain level of sentiment and animal spirits.
And supply and demand for treasuries from foreign and domestic, I mean, you know, the actual functioning of the 10-year.
So we use
the
10-year. Making a central bank intervention argument, which is a whole nother layer to the
right.
clutter.
To the clutter. Yeah. So there's a lot of clutter there. And okay. again, we risk veering into academic thought about a 3-month versus a 10-year. And some of the audience may or may not be into that. But it does show that the desire to have a risk-free rate is really powerful. So everyone's searching for the risk-free rate that they can then – a pure risk-free rate. And there's some great references in the literature, I'm sure, in the historical literature – John Kenyon Mains and others looking for the they referred to it decades ago, a century ago, as the natural rate of interest. You can find it centuries back.
Oh yeah.
You know what is the natural rate of interest, et cetera. And that's a fine academic argument, and I'll leave that to the academics. I'm more interested in the risk rate for businesses, and as a practical matter for making investments, the 10-year is awfully cluttered there, but the risk rate and the interest rate have been coming down for 40 years. And the book really tries to answer a singular question. What happens when interest rates or risk rates stop going down after 40 years? And that is where I think the return of the cash nexus is likely to be, because people are going to return to what I think is a more normal environment of expecting some sort of cash return for their investments. But what's the right number? I don't use the CAPM. Again, it's too cluttered. Is it for mature, stable companies, is the right discount rate high single digit? That is the right expected return from an investment? High single digits for something big and solid? Is it double digits and mid double digits for something riskier and much higher for venture capital? Yes. What's the exact number? That's gonna vary. I know it's probably not a CAPM derived figure, at least not for me. We tend to use more absolute return numbers. Cliff Asness and others have been attacking the use of IRRs, which have been used and abused by the private equity world. You probably have strong views on that. And I agree the way that then internal rate of return, which is a way of just coming up with an expected return without reference to other investments, the U.S. 10-year or some sort of risk-free rate, is liable to abuse, but it's an absolute number, and that's actually a realm in which I'm much more comfortable is using IRRs for the types of companies that we invest in. Again, it's not going to be blessed by the Academy. I sleep pretty well at night not being blessed by the Academy.
Yeah.
The Academy dates from the 50s and 60s, done some fine work. But they treat us all like ping pong balls in a lottery drawing machine. They treat us all like physics particles bouncing around.
Yeah.
And just human society is not that way. And I think the physics envy of modern finance is pretty well documented at this point. But I'm not inclined to continue to use CAPM.
Well, what you're doing is kind of taking a lot of the principles and beliefs and arguments that I make about modern economics all the time on this podcast and in other places, and applying it to modern finance. And I think you're exactly right. Their envy of physics in finance, I think, comes from the economics profession's envy of mathematics, which is driven by aim for greater central planning. And I think that they, if you believe that, to apply it on a macroeconomic level, if you believe that economics can be reduced to mathematics, you believe you need smart, powerful people doing it. And if you believe that finance can be reduced to theorem and formulaic calculation, then you need smart, powerful people doing it. If you, on the other hand, believe in the humanity of finance and the humanity of economics, you're forced to a much more humble and much more decentralized place. And that's where I have ended up, both as an economist and portfolio manager. It sounds like you're coming at it from a very similar perspective.
And even more, I'd throw in an extra dollop of history. If you look at the emergence of the natural sciences, they become professionalized in the 19th century, and they get way ahead of the humanities. Remember, social sciences is a term that doesn't exist until the mid-20th century. Yeah. So, and the humanities doesn't necessarily as well, but the sciences make tremendous progress in finding out the rules of the natural world in the 19th century. And in the 20th century, you have people looking at human society and they're trying to play catch up and saying, well, boy, the toolbox over there looks pretty good. It has firm and set knowable and discoverable rules. And that's what I think finance came up in that environment and macroeconomics came up in that environment in the search for the same rules that the natural sciences had. And in the course of that, they just botched it because we do not behave like physics, molecules bouncing around in molecules of pollen bouncing around in a vacuum, if I recall correctly, Brownian motion. I'm trying to remember all that. And that, if you see the time of when finance and economics, again, the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, looking for solutions to the Great Crash and the Depression, and seeing that their physics brethren across the quad at the university have all these rules, kind of a natural explanation that they went in that direction. Doesn't necessarily mean make it right. It made it convenient to have physics rules. It made it convenient to have the Journal of Finance explain human behavior down to the fifth or sixth decimal point. Didn't make it right, but it did make it very good for teaching and very good for explanations. It just didn't necessarily make it right.
Yeah, I was. I had a guest on the podcast a little over a year ago, Glory Liu, who I think wrote an authoritative book on the history of Adam Smith. And I was intrigued to find out that in the 19th century, in this sort of pursuit of greater exploration in natural sciences and whatnot, that economics was stripped out of the moral philosophy departments at Harvard and across the Ivy League. And I think that I've concluded, as I sort of did a more historical analysis of it, that that was kind of the beginning of the end in terms of viewing economics as I view it, which is more of a human discipline and less of a science and math discipline. And I think I wonder what the chicken or egg is there. Were they in pursuit of better extraction of the lessons of natural science, or were they in pursuit of trying to squash the moral philosophy of economics? I don't know what was driving what. I do know what the consequences have been, and I'm not particularly
The graveyards of the 20th century are filled with the consequences of that effort. Yeah. A little less darkly, I'll just again point out the term social science. If you see the word social science, run.
Yeah.
Because that is a contradiction in terms.
Sure.
You see it even in more
benign
areas.
Do you think moral philosophy is a contradiction in terms?
No, I do not. I mean, Adam Smith's making a big comeback, both of his works, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, I believe. Is it Theory of Moral Sentiments? I'm trying to remember the first book. Yeah. He's making a good comeback, as he should, and social science should really recede a little. You know, we're in agreement in that regard.
So in terms of the application of some of these lessons, the historical takeaways, is some of it overlapped with the last 20 years of what's taken place to where we are now? The interest rate change is one thing, that secular decline that really lasted about 40 years in the 10-year that was the significant factor, as you've laid it out, in terms of mainstream investing appetite. The interest that minority investors ought in an enterprise ought to have around cash flows is different than where the sentiment might pull them or where media and public focus may lie. But there is a decade in the middle of this period that I wonder, is it an interruption to your thesis, or where does it fit in? And I refer to from 2000 to 2009, because there's no question that the 90s and obviously FANG of the post-crisis era, ZIRP, QE, you had an awful lot of things lined up. And then during the 90s, you had very difficult to really get excited about Philip Morris's dividend when pets.com was going up 20% a day or whatever the heck was going on. But there was a lost decade there. I credit it as sort of making my career, certainly helping to begin my career as I've been managing money now for 25 years. It was the fact of the matter is that the S&P essentially didn't grow on a total return basis, certainly not much on a price return basis. And dividend growing equities did quite well. Is there a sense in which part of this is overlapped with just the general value growth divide, not so much around cash flows, but other factors?
Yeah, your point is well taken. I suppose I've stepped back almost too much because, as you say, interest rates 40 years, the dividends being stripped from the market really 30 years because it really becomes evident in the math in the mid-1990s. So you have the factors come into play, the environment comes into play in the early 80s, the lines cross between buybacks and dividends in the mid-90s, and you have this environment from the 90s to the present. But you're right, in between the two bubbles, as it were, a bubble and a crash, if you weren't doing the standard thing, you did pretty well. That is, if you had the conservative investments from 2000 to 2008 or 9, March of 2009, you did very well. Fair point. I do think, though, that the broader trend, that is a function of how high NASDAQ got in March of 2000, not so much a pause and people thinking. I made my career at that point as well. I joined Federated in 2002 and had a conservative bias even for the job that I had briefly for a couple years before coming to Federated. And that gave me a platform to develop a career. But even then, it was still kind of a boutique strategy. I mean, the notion that growth will come back in some form or another, or respectable growth, seemed to be overwhelming. So I don't know if there was a moment in the market sentiment saying, hey, maybe we should think about this. I really think more broadly that the last 30 years of practical market history and 40 years of framework have been going in one direction. But of course, when we had a bubble burst and then we had a financial crisis, that was going to change investment practicalities, at least for a number of years. If you look at the last 15 years from March 2009 to the present, it's only been, you know, one concept, one direction. And that's a pretty long investment period for people. So you can make the point that the what I refer to as a historical anomaly itself has an anomaly within it of you know 5, 6, 7, 8 years, but broadly speaking, it's been 40 years in one direction.
And so, as you look forward over the next 10 years, what are some of the, you know, as we sit here talking right now, you have an S&P trading both trailing and forward well above 20 times. You have some of the most popular stocks trading at double or triple that from a PE valuation standpoint. You have a 10-year that has right size to some degree. It's still sitting around 4%. People talk like it's very high. It's actually kind of historically low, but nevertheless much higher than it's been for the almost 95% of the last 15 years. And you have a significant amount of population who needs cash flow from their investment. So their investing objective is to put money in a checking account monthly. Do you believe that part of the environment that is appetizing right now for a return of cash flow sensibilities is the demographic reality of what people are investing for? Do you think that those things will play in any kind of meaningful secular sense?
They should have, and they should have for a while. And I'm sure the profile of your clients would suggest, where have they been? And I think I have an answer for that, meaning they've been with you, but they have been harvesting capital gains for the last 15 years to fund consumption. So the baby boomers started their move out to retirement, not in 2024, but in years before.
Yeah.
Yet for those last 15 years, there's been up until 2022, 2023, there's really no source of income to fund retirement and consumption. So the only, neither from money funds, fixed income, or from equities, other than your products and my products. But how have they funded consumption? How's the population funded consumption? Well, with harvested capital gains. And again, in modern academic finance, a harvested capital gain, or they don't refer to it as harvested capital gain, but a capital gain is equal to a dividend payment. So everything's fine. Wall Street makes a lot more money off of harvested capital gains than they do off of dividends. The kind of generator perceived to be of the harvested capital gains is buybacks. So corporations are contributing. So I think that part of the anomaly we've seen the last 15 years is that that demographic push that you would expect for the return of the cash nexus, that is retirees, baby boomers who are retiring en masse right now. I am the last year of the baby boom. I'm 1964. That the that instead of demanding cash from their investments, they have been able to, God bless, it's worked out really well, been able to simply harvest capital gains. Absolutely nothing wrong with that. But it's very, very different. A harvested capital gain is very different from a dividend payment. A dividend payment is a business outcome. A harvested capital gain involves thousands of people and is a market outcome. And it may or may not have much to do with the underlying business. Nothing wrong with that. It's worked really well the last 15 years. But as a business owner, bringing a business owner sensibility to the stock market, I'm going to call that out, step back and say, that's pretty lucky, pretty good, worked pretty well. But do you know how unusual that is? Normally, most investments that can be used to fund consumption have an income stream associated with them. Here's a whole swath of investments that are being used to fund consumption that have no income stream associated with them, or a de minimis one. I'm glad it's worked out really well for everyone. But it is unusual. And is it going to last now that, back to the coda, now that interest rates have stopped going down?
I think you're being even more sanguine about how it has gone than I would be in this sense. I think you're right. If you take a far enough look back, that overall in aggregate, there's no question that harvested capital gains and then from the pool of unrealized gains that one may choose to realize for the point of consumption, that divorced from any real life mechanics and timing has been perfectly adequate to fund these things, boomers, retirement, spending, et cetera. But I write a chapter in my book on dividend growth about this, which was such a catalytic component to me converting to dividend growth investing. And that was the period of 2000 to 2002, which now with the benefit of 25 years, we can look back to the S&P dropping from what, 1500 to 900 or something and laugh about it because we're back at 4,500 or 5,000. But yet at the time, it was just the simple reality that somebody who went all in on this sort of let's harvest capital gains and live off of them, let's eat unrealized capital gains, that over in that particular case was a 30-month drawdown from March of 2000 to October of 2002, that people ran out of money, that they permanently negatively compounded their base so that when those capital gains came back, which they most certainly did, they did so for the investor at a reduced denominator, and therefore they couldn't participate in the recovery because they had permanently impeded. And that to me is a really important mathematical component that I admit is somewhat mechanical, but nevertheless an important mechanical one, which is that the general need of cash flows for human beings is consistent and the ability to harvest capital gains is not. And so tying in the consistency of dividends to the consistency of cash flow, if the only time my wife wanted to spend money was when there were unrealized capital gains, then life would be a lot simpler. It just so happens to not really work that way. Now, I joke, I have a whole different argument for people like myself, they're in accumulation phase that don't touch their dividends. But to your point about those who do need the dividends, I think that not only are you right in a more normalized environment that people got away with being able to sort of bank on unrealized gains at a level that was somewhat ahistorical, but that even in cyclical moments within that secular age, that a lot of damage could have been done that theoretically from those more severe drawdowns. The COVID one ended up being very, very short-lived. But both the 07 to 09 drawdown and the 2000-2002 drawdown, with a more modest denominator and a withdrawal rate that is somewhat normal, let's call it 4%, people could have permanently impeded their balance sheet's ability to withstand future cash flow needs.
Yeah, and the harvested capital loss concept, I make fun of it a little bit in the book because everyone only talks about harvested capital gains, but it is quite possible to find yourself, as you point out, that facing harvested capital losses to fund consumption. Then you're going to wonder, well, why didn't I go down the income path? Recall that in the internet bubble, if you held a conservative portfolio of dividend-paying stocks, your income was largely unimpaired. There was almost no damage from that bubble bursting because none of those companies that went up so sharply had dividends to begin with. Right. During the great financial crisis, the income was impaired because not substantially across a broad market, but from the financial sector, because a lot of financial companies did cut their distribution.
But even then, so there is, you mean that on a more of an index level?
Index level, yeah, and exactly. That is the aggregate dividend wasn't really hurt. Even though the share prices got crushed in both cases, the aggregate dividend was not hurt at all, really, in the first instance, and only somewhat in the second instance. Again, that's a reason to focus what's on real and tangible and not just on the share prices. And there we're agreeing vociferously with one another there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and so in terms of the go forward, how much for you as a dividend growth portfolio manager with a doctoral level of understanding of history, how much are you thinking about macroeconomics? And how much are you thinking about bottom-up company specifics?
Yeah, a day job tends to be the latter, that is company specifics bottom-up. And then the night job is the macro. Yeah. So I do expect the return of the cash nexus. That is, interest rates have stopped going down. Some of the other benign environmental factors have dissipated. I expect people to expect more cash. You saw Meta and Salesforce announce dividends. I think you're going to see more large tech companies and some non-tech companies return to cash because in order to compete in the asset allocation exercise, they're going to have to. So I am forecasting that. That'll make our jobs both easier and harder. We'll have more companies to choose from, harder because we'll have more companies to choose from. That's the bottom up. From the top down, the macro part that I think many of your listeners might be interested in is we're really in a transition from one paradigm to the other. And it's playing out in real time on our televisions. 2024 is going to be huge in regard to that. I mean, the risks are very, very high. We had a settled law, settled paradigm for 40 years. Global neoliberalism, it meant certain things. In many ways, you probably would disagree with this. Both Republican and Democratic administrations broadly subscribed to it until Donald Trump showed up.
I would absolutely agree with that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So you had broadly speaking, consensus approach in this country about what was good, what was not good from a macroeconomic perspective. That's all been shattered. Yeah. And I am not arrogant enough to tell you exactly what the new paradigm is going to look like macroeconomically. But what I have observed, and I think you may have seen this in consuming macroeconomic advice and commentaries, is the variance, the degree to which people currently just don't know. There's the variances in expectations about how the global economy is going to perform are the greatest that I've ever seen. That is, it's not like there's a consensus. It's not even a consensus about the range is too big. You have reasonable people forecasting the end of time. You have reasonable people forecasting a new bull market. And that's, I think, a consequence of this paradigm shift where the contours of the new paradigm, more regulation, a little more localism, interest rates that are not zero, politics, which are a mess, a global mess, hot wars around the world, not just cold wars. That's a real challenging environment to figure out. If you're doing a capital plan for the next 20 or 30 years, let's say you're a global utility of some sort or some sort of global business, it's more challenging than it would have been when the answer was, well, we manufacture in China, we bring the items to Long Beach, we pass by David Bonson's office, and we get them to the deflation producing Walmart store within days of their being consumed. You know, that perfect, what I refer to as Wall Street efficiency environment. And instead, I think we're going to move more towards the need for corporations to be more efficacious, governments to some extent, people to be more efficacious. And it's a paradigm shift, and there's a lot of uncertainty ahead of it. That's going to create risk and opportunities for everyone.
What's fascinating is that you have really gotten to a conclusion I believe in very strongly, and some of the premises behind it are ones that I'm really in tune with, and some are ones I haven't thought about before, and so I'm learning a great deal myself. But I notice when you talk about the neoliberal order, the geopolitics, obviously the rate issue we've talked about from a macroeconomic standpoint, but where do you think the fiscal policy and even just the monetary policy, and I don't mean monetary policy just simply in reference to what it does to interest rates, but just what it does to distortions, to the intervention level. I focus on those two categories a lot as a further case for why the stability of cash flow growth and investing lends itself to dividends in the paradigm that the fiscal insanity and monetary insanity has gotten to a point that has driven us to here as well. Are those two categories on your radar as well around this subject?
Yeah, I think, again, I hate to sound monotonous, but I think that what you refer to as fiscal insanity and monetary insanity, in effect, were enabled and part and part of the declining interest rates on one hand, because that enabled the fiscal insanity or facilitated, maybe not caused it, but created an environment in which you could get away with that. And of course, the lower interest rates are part and part of the monetary insanity. You may have interviewed Edward Chancellor in The Price of Time, his longer look at the implications of interest rates. Clearly,
it's our most listened to podcast we ever had.
Not surprising. Right. Well worth the price of admission. I would turn around, but I would throw off my microphone, but the book's right there. It's a fine work. I also interviewed him for another podcast that I do. Interest rates have been cut. And also there's Paul Schmelzing, who's an academic finance historian who's looked at 1,000 years of declining interest rates and what it does. So it clearly distorted many, many things. And fiscal and monetary policy is one of them. You pointed out earlier, interest rates need to be, are not low, they're normal. So a 10-year at 4%, 5%, or 6% is not high. It's not higher for longer. It's normal for longer. Mm-hmm. Everyone should get used to it. But I do think there's a day of reckoning coming, for the U.S. as the global hegemon. If you're a global hegemon, you really ought to behave a little more responsibly over the last half century. And I think there's plenty of evidence for that in the rise of cryptocurrencies. I'm not a big fan. I have issues as to whether they function as a store of value and a medium of exchange, but their very existence is evidence of kind of, I think, the failure of the financial hegemon to extend that hegemony longer rather than shorter. If you look at the history of England and France and Spain, Spain ran out of silver. The Dutch eventually got out-traded. The British eventually got out. Larger hegemons arose. So each of these countries and dominant financial hegemons had their day. The French just blew it. Forgotten them. So Spain, France, Holland, the UK. Then it became the United States. And I love It's Morning in America again. 1980. I subscribe to that, but. If you want to stay at the top of your game, you got to stay at the top of your game. And the fiscal and monetary policy of the last couple of decades. Now, again, we have to run deficits in order for the U.S. dollar to be the global currency. That's kind of a technical issue that some people who uncomfortable with trade deficits may not be in alignment with, but kind of a technical inside baseball thing. But beyond that,
we should clarify. You mean trade? We have to run trade deficits to keep dollar reserve status. We don't have to run budget deficits.
We do not have to run budget deficits. Yes. So, and we would be better off with fewer budget deficits. So, yeah, that part's a mess. And you see, I think the failing to some extent, the failing of the political consensus as well as the emergence of cryptocurrency is evidence of that kind of late in the game environment that I think that we're in. You know, hopefully sober minds will prevail. I don't see any. Do you see any sober? Do you see any sober minds anywhere from in where you're sitting?
I do actually, but I don't see them running for president. I don't see them as the Speaker of the House or the Senate Majority Leader or the current Secretary of State, White House Chief of Staff. They're not in those positions. There's some sober minds out there right now, but I think that we're a remnant.
Yeah,
and we're playing defense. For me, the optimism comes from the fact I believe in the ideas, and I think the ideas will prevail. But I don't at all take lightly what you're referring to, which is that we have not stewarded the legacy of our great ideas well.
Yes, sadly, I have to agree with you about that. And there it becomes complacency. Again, when you're well into a paradigm, like the English were in the early 20th century, they thought that, why would anything change here? It's working out so well. And other various degrees of arrogance, whether it was, Dutch, French, or Spanish, complacency is a killer. And
one of the things I feel we're dealing with now that comes up a lot. I just recently did a podcast here at Capital Record with Louis Gov of GovCal Research, where we were talking about the US dollar. One of the differences I think is that in those moments of this hegemonic transition, the country that forfeited its position was in a highly competitive scenario against other countries that were more than willing to pick up the mantle. And that's one thing that I just don't think people realize how much the U.S. has been a beneficiary. Our own complacency has been driven by other countries' refusal to get their act together.
Europe tried, and I'm going to say sadly, just because it was an interesting concept, but Europe tried and failed. The European Union's just not working out the way they imagined it would. It was a good faith effort, but too much centralized control and a weak form. Either they needed to go fully federal or not do it at all. And they went confederation. And as we in our own history figured out, confederation is a very weak form of organizing a society. China's making a bid. Russia, the Eastern Bloc failed. China's making a bid. I think the United States is hanging on in part as a hegemon successfully because, as you point out, the others have failed to compete. I also think, and this came up when I was touring Europe recently, it's hard to understate the importance of NASDAQ Silicon Valley. That is, those companies, for better or for ill, I mean, I'm kind of a fan of some of them, but I understand the dark side. But the rest of the world just doesn't have those companies. And they are extending the run quite a bit. Good.
That's a great point. And even though I would imagine for yourself like me, that's not a huge part of my investment universe. It's not a huge part of my political affiliation. And yet within the macroeconomic reality and the geopolitical reality, Silicon Valley most certainly has been a net positive to the US's position of strength. And so even someone who doesn't have other skin in the game with them should be able to objectively acknowledge that. I really want to encourage listeners to check out this book. I am going to put the link in the show notes and really say that The Ownership Dividend, The Coming Paradigm Shift in the U.S. Stock Market by today's guest, Daniel Paris, is going to be one of the more important books you read in 2024, not only for those that are interested in capital markets and investment finance, as a lot of you are, but I think that his ability and expertise to bring history to analysis is really, really important. I personally could sit here and talk to you for hours more. I've enjoyed it thoroughly. I've learned, And we'll be learning even more with the book. So, Daniel, thank you very, very much. And please do come back again. Join us on Capitol Record.
David, thank you so much for having me. I look forward to coming back. Take care.
Te presentamos a Alex. Ella acaba de descubrir el centro de visión de Walmart.
Ahora hago mis diligencias en un solo lugar.
¿Compras? ¿Lentes?
Walmart.
¿Decoraciones?
Walmart. Y lo mejor es que aceptan la mayoría de seguros, así que ahorro tiempo y dinero.
Bienvenido a un cuidado de visión más fácil. Bienvenido a tu Walmart. Se aplican restricciones. Visita walmart.com para más detalles.